This is the fifth session of an interview with Harry Medlin on the 28th of September 2007. Interviewer Rob Lynn for the University of Adelaide Oral History. Harry, over the last two sessions we've covered a lot of ground. We were coming back today just to talk a little bit, firstly about your own papers that go back to your origins at Adelaide Uni. Where have they ended up, Harry?
When I retired from the physics department, I stayed around the Alumni Association for a few years. And finally, when I left physics and moved into the Alumni Association, Alumni House on Kinder Avenue, I assembled all of the historical stuff that I had and handed it over to Susan Woodburn, the special collections librarian. And the material, very little of it is embargoed. There's some stuff that's embargoed, but very little. Most of it is open and available, and especially the material about the origin of the Adelaide University Union bookshop. And I've referred the bookshop people to that history of the bookshop. I actually convened the first Union Bookshop Committee in 1961, but we were not able to take it over from the WA Book Room until 1969. And I was then given the honour of naming the bookshop, provided I called it the Adelaide University Union Bookshop Proprietary Limited. And it was a registered company, while the Adelaide University Union was still an informal body that only became incorporated afterwards. It was in 1997 that the executive committee of the Adelaide University Union resolved that Unibooks, as they came to call it, was a wholly owned subsidiary of the Adelaide University Union. And I think I might have referred to it last week. It's just like my saying, I think that I own your house. One company takes over another. All that material is in the special collections of the Barsmith Library. It's about 20 plus boxes of it, I remember. Susan did catalogue it. So catalogue does exist. You don't, if anybody want to look at it, they don't have to go through the whole lot in order to find what they're after.
Harry, I'd like to talk about the new union and the bookshop as well when we get to the expansion of the buildings at the university in more detail. Mm-hmm. The other matter we were talking about earlier were the festival performances with which you were involved in 1962 and 68. No, sorry, 1966 and 68.
Yeah.
And just wondered if you could talk about the programs that I have in front of me here.
Yeah, well, I'd like you to have those programs. I spent study leave in 64-65 at King's College, London, in Drury Lane, and we were able to go to Stratford and also to the Royal Shakespeare Company up south of the Thames, and I was fascinated by the way that they handled their program material. Cast lists, for example, were cheaply produced and were put on all the seats in the theatre free. So you weren't obliged to buy a program in order to find the cast and the parts that they were playing. There were also programs, and I was inspired by this. On returning to Adelaide, I was still running the Theatre Guild, and we produced a double header in the 1966 festival. The Adelaide University Theatre Guild, in association with the Adelaide University Union, presents John Curtin's Off to the Diggings and James Tucker's Jemmy Green in Australia. Two Australian films, plays. And we were helped by Brideson. Peter O'Shaughnessy did the directing. And I introduced Peter to Hedley Brightson, who was the librarian at the time, and they were very, very helpful indeed. So there's historical material in the program about both Jemmy Green and Off to the Digs, And we have in the centre fold the original programme of Off to the Diggings, or London Schemes in 1852, as they were prepared to come out to Ballarat and Bendigo and to the goldfields. Fascinating. I have my little dunny on the back of the programme. It's the dunny from the back of the Queen's Theatre.
This is the Harry Medlin brand.
Yeah. We repeated that festival programming on several occasions, but the other one that I have here, Rob, is a special program for the recruiting officer. Fark was the recruiting officer, prepared for the 1968 festival. I think I spoke before about some of the troubles with the Board of Governors with the with that festival. At that festival, we were privileged in the union to have been able to share with the University of Adelaide Art Fund Committee the buying of that series of 12 paintings by Arthur Boyd. And there's a little slip in the inserted in the program that those 12 paintings were displayed for the first time in the cellar bar in the Union Hall to coincide with the official opening of the recruiting officer. Fack was the recruiting officer. I was privileged to be the executive producer of that production, and to work with Peter O'Shaughnessy and professional actors provided for us by the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust.
Now, Harry, that cellar bar and coffee lounge, as it became too, had that only recently been completed when the play was put on?
It was completed expressly for the opening production of the recruiting officer in the festival. Previously, it had just been a basement which was used as a locker room. I was fortunate in being able to get an architect, Albert Gillison, Dutchman, to help me with the design of the carrels. You probably remember there was a series of carrels there, discrete carrels, and the decorating of the columns. It staggers me what Albert was able to do. The hideous columns were decorated and really became most attractive. We also, at that time, had the first theatre liquor bar.
Yes.
Chris Sumner and I appeared before the Royal Commission into the changing of the liquor laws. It was the Dunstan government. I was interviewed at the Royal Commission by John Jefferson Bray. He had his back to the Commissioner, so he was able to communicate with me in a variety of ways that the Commissioner was unaware of. Anyway, the law was changed to allow bars in places like that. I then appeared before the magistrate who, after the law had been changed, was granting the licences, and it was Roy Grubb.
G-R-U-B-B.
G-R-U-B-B. Very active around the theatre with a rep. And I'd known his wife when we first came down from RRE, so it was a very familial thing. Well, we got the licence for the liquor bar, and that also opened for the first night. And if you look behind me, you'll see a beer can, which was the first can dispensed over the bar.
It's a Southwark can of old design.
Exactly.
So, Harry, the Arthur Boyd paintings are probably worth talking about themselves, yes, given that they're such a significant collection.
Yes. Well, there was a philosophy professor, Peter Glow, and he at that time was the chairman of the Works of Art Fund Committee, and they commissioned Arthur Boyd to do a painting to put in the foyer of the Napier Building. In those days, there was little, if any, vandalism, and I think they thought that it might have been safe to have such a painting there. Well, Boyd, like other painters, have ideas of their own, and when the material turned up, it turned out to be 12 much smaller paintings of in the judges' series. The most outstanding one, I think, is Nebuchadnezzar, the one with his back on fire, and I forget what actual colour his scrotum is, but one of the things that disturbed the so-called liberal-minded arts professors was the variety of scrota that appeared in the paintings of the judges' series, and they declined to have them. So Peter Glow came to me, and I was active around the theatre and around the union, came to me almost in tears. What, we spent $2,500 or whatever? It cost nothing. $2,500, what are we going to do? So I actually persuaded the Adelaide University Union to share half the cost. And we mounted them then. They were ram-setted to the wall in the cellar behind the carrels, and they were there at the opening of that festival play, the recruiting officer, and the cellar bar, and the Boyd paintings. And in the program that I'm giving you, there's a little note been inserted that gives a brief history. Those paintings now have been shifted to a more secure site there over in the main union building. And there's a little plaque there that briefly describes the history. I would guess that Nebuchadnezzar might well be worth $1 million. And he was just one of 12 that cost $2,400 in 1968.
I'd say on current values, money well spent, Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking about that, Harry. Just taking something completely different now and going back into the form of the interview from last week. In the first session we did, which is about a month ago, we did begin to talk about the impact of the post-war student intake from Asia into the university under the Colombo Plan. And Harry, you had significant dealings with people and the plan itself.
Yeah. The First Nation students, I remember, were pre-Colombo Plan students. They were actually UNESCO. They were on UNESCO scholarships.
Okay.
They came, curiously, from Palestine. I don't think I know how that came to be, but those whom I knew came principally from Indonesia. And this was before the before Indonesia won its independence, and I think I've referred to the fact that as a Japanese prisoner of war in Indonesia towards the end of the war, most of us Australian soldiers were on the side of the Indonesians. What was called Merdeka. Merdeka in Bahasa Indonesia means freedom, and Tetap, which means now, not tomorrow, but right now. So we were on their side, so I got to know these Indonesian students. UNESCO, one of them was called Iskanto, and I can't remember if I referred to Iskanto.
In the first interview you did.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we can cut then to the Colombo Plan. The Colombo, the then Australian Minister for, I think, External Affairs, Percy Spender, attended a meeting in Colombo, a meeting of foreign ministers, in about January or February of 1951. And it was there that Australia promoted a Colombo Plan for the educating of our near northern Asian students. That took some 6 months. I think preparatory work had been done before by the Labor government, before that was before Menzies won the election in December of 1949,
it must
10th of December 1949, I think. Well, then Percy Spender, Australia was very actively involved. I believe that we've had something like about 40,000 Colombo Plan students. They're incredible. In the tribute that I have written to our Asian friends and colleagues, I have listed quite a number of the now well-known students from Indonesia, from Singapore, from West Malaysia, and from Sarawak and Sabah. The present Chief Minister of Sarawak, PN3, Haji Dr. Abdul Taib bin Mahmud, friend of mine, whose wife was taught by my late wife in Adelaide Girls High School. He's a Colombo Plan student. Datuk Dr. Sam Abraham, former Chief Pediatrician to Mahathir Mohamad, Colombo Plan student. Gopal Srinivasan, who introduced renal dialysis and then renal transplants. Joseph Paran Kittingan is the Deputy Chief Minister of Sarawak, Colombo Plan student. And it goes some 20% of the Malaysian cabinet, Colombo Plan. Rob, it is not possible to do a cost-benefit analysis on something of that sort. We couldn't possibly put a value. It is invaluable, the goodwill that has come to come to us out of the Colombo Plan. I was privileged to set up chapters of our alumni association in Kuala Lumpur in May of 1994, and in Singapore in May of 1995. I was acting chancellor, or I represented the chancellor rather, in 2001, when there was established the chapter, Sarawakian chapter, of our alumni association. Subsequently, there are further chapters in Singapore, in the United States, and in England. It seems to me to be a tragedy that it was a Labor government that stopped the Colombo Plan. There's still, in my personal view, there's still grounds for continuing the Colombo Plan, not for undergraduate students, because the thing to have done, which has been done, is to encourage those countries to have their own world-class universities. And the University of Singapore is as good a university as any Australian one. But there is still room for postgraduate education and research activity, in my opinion, encouraged and stimulated by the Colombo Plan. I was privileged to be a guest speaker at the Golden Jubilee of the Colombo Plan in Kuala Lumpur. It was held in the High Commission in Kuala Lumpur on the 1st of July 2001, 50 years to the day, to the start of the Colombo Plan. And it was a most auspicious occasion. The public space in that High Commission was full, and we stopped it.
Harry, am I right in thinking that the entertainer Kamal was a Colombo Plan student at Adelaide University? Harry Wesley Smith once told me that.
I know Kamal. I tried to teach him Physics 1, but he wasn't interested. He was much, much more interested in singing at a nightclub on Anzac Highway opposite what used to be Gibbs Pie at Pie Palace. I don't think he was a Colombo Plan student. I'm not sure how it was he came here, but Kamal certainly went to King's College, which became part of Pembroke when my wife managed to fuse Girton Girls' School and King's College into Pembroke. Yes, I've seen Kamal. I can't tell you his whole name. Kamal's just the first part of the Indian expanse. Yeah, He's another one of those who used to call me Gregory Peck.
Well, I'm pleased to hear that, Harry. I think Harry, talking about the tremendous success of the Colombo Plan, both from Australia's point of view and from the country's point of view from which the people came, that leads me into asking you more about the Alumni Association, in which there's a strong connection, as you just pointed out. How did you come to be involved with the alumni?
There was a move in Adelaide in 1920 to have an alumni association. It didn't take off, but there was in parallel with it the old graduates union. They have a very very complete records, and they probably now are in the special collection in the Barsmith Library. The person whom I dealt with was the late Dr. Winnie Wool. She was very very active in the Graduates Union, and it was suggested, and Don Stranks encouraged this, it was suggested that we create an alumni association. A review was held of graduate activity. It was chaired by a relative of yours, Dr. Jennifer Lynn. And Jenny Lynn had this working party of about five. I think Warren Rogers, the then warden of the union, was a member of it. And they made a report to the University Council, a report on the university and its graduates. And they recommended that this would have been 1984. And they, as I say, they recommended the creating of an alumni association. I've been very active in the Adelaide University Union, the Theatre Guild, the Staff Association, both locally, and I was national president. And I think they thought that I might have been able to do something to create this body. I was appointed by the University Council on the recommendation of the late Don Stranks, Vice-Chancellor, in February of 1985, and we planned for about 6 months based on the recommendations of Jenny Lynn's working party. We planned the creation of the Alumni Association, initially in parallel with the Graduates Union, mm-hmm. but finally, after I think about 2 years, there was a merger, and the Alumni Association took over the activities and the enthusiasm of those older graduates. And Jenny Lynn, I think, was both Jenny Lynn and Wynne Wool. Well, Wynne was older than Jenny, but I think they were both getting a little bit tired at that time. We were a vigorous body. We were given space, rent-free space, in the Mitchell Building. We outgrew that, and I persuaded Don Stranks to let us have what became known as Alumni House. And if you look at it, the name is still on on the front, the corner of Kintore Avenue and that Kintore Avenue Gate 13, I think, entrance. It was two levels. It had previously been the home of the university caretaker, Peter Turnbull. That activity was shut down, and we took it over. My executive director was Geoffrey Sawyer.
Yeah.
Geoff had been involved with the generating and creating of a lot of the activities in the Mitchell Building for the University Centenary in 1974. So he was fairly familiar with that sort of communal activity. And he was the executive secretary. We had a staff of four, sometimes five. We rebuilt the database virtually from nothing to 55,000. There were annual fees. They were only something like $30 or $40 for 20 times. You could take out a life membership. I think I managed to become the first life member, paid up life member of the. And there's a life members board, an initial members board in the alumni facilities over on, presently over on North Terrace. So we had a number of honour boards created. There is a board of the first 1,000 founding members, a lot of whom sadly have now died. Peter Balan, who subsequently became acting chair when I finished as the chair in 1998. Peter Balan was member number two, and I think George Mayo, my old friend, was probably three or four or five. And it's a very interesting collection of names. And it showed that the university was extending itself beyond just its staff and its students to its alumni and to its friends. We inaugurated Golden Jubilees, and I was a member of the council at the time, and the university council, in fact deputy chancellor. Kimber Knighton was set up to organise the sesquicentenary celebrations, and he appealed to the community to take some action. I persuaded the university that the Golden Jubilee in the Benython Hall would be the 50th anniversary, the Golden Jubilee of the Benython Hall, and would be the anniversary, the sesquicentenary anniversary of the state of South Australia. Warren Benython was actually the guest speaker, and he had to confess that he was a great disappointment to his family because chasing girls so much, and he said this himself publicly, chasing girls so much as he did, he didn't graduate in 1936, but didn't graduate until a year later. So he was not actually a Golden Jubilee graduate in 1986. But he spoke very, very engagingly. Well, that has become an annual custom now. After the internet, I think you're asking me principally about Colombo Plan students. I did mention the name of a number of them. As I say, I was guest speaker at the at the Golden Jubilee in Kuala Lumpur on the 1st of July 2001.
How do they view the alumni, Harry? How do the Colombo Plan Stroke Asian alumni view being alumni of the University of Adelaide?
Very, very favourably, and they still are. There are very active associations. David Goh is president in Singapore. Robert Lowe is president in Kuala Lumpur. Roger Chan is the executive secretary in Sabah. Those students who were at the time either Colombo Plan students or were here as private students. Some of them call themselves Father Plan students. Here as private students are very fondly attached to the university. They do regard themselves as alumni, as part of the university. There's a changing attitude, however. Those older ones are finding it more difficult to get the younger ones to join in the level of activity. Why? The younger ones say, we've paid our way, we owe you nothing. Furthermore, when they get back home, their life is pretty competitive. So they're not as prepared to spend as much of their visionary activities as were those older ones. I would hesitate to predict what the long-term future would be. I know for sure that it is being said by many in Asia and Southeast Asia, that what used to be called the Ugly Americans, you know, Graham Greene's Ugly Americans,
yes,
coming to be called the Greedy Australians. And if you look at the development plan for our universities and the constraints put on us by principally the federal government to raise full fee-paying student places, I say again, Rob, I would hesitate to predict what the future would be. It will not be as rosy as the past.
Harry, just contemplating that era of the Colombo Plan and into the 60s and 70s, it was a time of mass expansion of the university, and we mentioned this last week. You were very involved in not just the Union Hall, but in the planning for the new Union and the Union Bookshop. Now, I wonder, could we spend some time talking about that now? Because that's become a pivot, not just for students, but for people using those facilities.
Yeah. Credit has been paid to me and to others in that paper that I gave you that came out at the time of the naming of the Harry Medlin rooms, yeah. The old north-south dining rooms in the Union were renamed a couple of years ago, the Harry Medlin rooms. And it was acknowledged then the effort and vision and imagination that a number of us, I'm not the only one, there's an emeritus professor of mathematical physics, Angus Hurst, who actually chaired the Union Planning Committee. I was active on that planning committee. Our architects were Hassel. No, our architects were
Robert Dixon, Bob Dixon.
Yeah, Dixon and Platten.
Dixon and Platten.
Yeah. And they also did Kathleen Lumley College.
We'll come to that.
Yeah. And it, it was marvellous to see and to experience the way that enthusiasm and imagination could be converted into bricks and mortar. We were very concerned to preserve as much as possible of the early history of the Union, in particular the Simon building and the George Murray, and they have been preserved and they've been integrated. We were also concerned to preserve the cloisters.
Yeah.
Now, those cloisters are War Memorial, World War One Memorial cloisters, and there is a plaque there now to that effect. On the southern side, we integrated the eastern and western and northern parts of the cloisters with the new extensions. Part of those new extensions, and we tried to preserve as much of the Helen Mayo refectory. In the book, The Lower Level, there's a beautiful photograph of the women in the Helen Mayo refectory. We tried to preserve as much of that as possible, but there were added on the activity rooms. And a workplace, a little theatre, and then the bookshop. Now, I might have said earlier that I chaired the first bookshop inquiry in 1961 for the Adelaide University Union. We made the recommendations. They went through the Union Council to the University Council. The principal recommendation was that bookselling, like victualling, was a central responsibility. Reminds me a little bit of what used to be the platform, part of the platform of the Australian Labor Party, the socialisation, the means of production, distribution, and exchange. They've now slung it out, of course. But book selling in Italy. Now, when the refectory first started, it was just a victualling and excreting device, refectory and lavatories. Early with the Colombo plan, we converted part of the basement of the George Murray to a prayer room for Muslims. And then we had a further prayer room in the Union Extensions upstairs, just south of the first floor of the Lady Simon Library. I think it's now called the Helen Men's Room, or was called the Helen Men's Room. So there was a lot of imagination went into the conceiving and guessing in some respects. What was likely to be the student population. Now, the ex-service students doubled the student population from, I think it said 2,300 to 4,700. Well, at the time that the extensions were opened, the student population was up to about 10,000. Well, it's now up to about 18,000, so things get a bit congested. When I went back to the university in 1946, there were hardly any lavatories. There were public lavatories for students at the back of what is now the Mitchell Building.
Yeah.
There was an old lavatory there, just where the WEA book room used to be. And indeed, one Tuesday after Easter, they found a dead cadaver in there. There were other lavatories at the back of the old psych building, now replaced by the Prince of Wales building. In the Barsmith Library, I believe that there were lavatories for the librarian, but I think the rest of the staff had to nick through to the to the union. So it victualling and the effects of victualling became a central responsibility. And as I say, we argued that book selling should. Now, I was one of those who argued that, because in 1948, Kevin McGarry, my late wife, who was then Diana Dester Walker, and I were members of the National Union of Australian University Students Council. The Chief Justice, Sir Gerald Brennan, was one of the Queensland members. We were a pretty active lot. We proposed that we should be allowed, that the national union should be allowed to become a book importer, because there was quite a risk, quite a problem with book selling. Even Ethel Payne strongly believed in one price for all. Now, that's not really the way to go about it, we felt, and when the Adelaide University Union took over the WEA book room, we actually took Ethel Payne as the manager, and we had to re-educate Ethel that there were discounts for union and student members that broke the principle of one price for all. So it's a tricky bit. And after the war, there were entrepreneurial activities. I remember one that was opposite the university. The bookshop itself has gone, the Argonaut.
Oh, Argonaut, yes, of course. Yeah.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they were pretty entrepreneur. Muir?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, Beck Book Company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up in Pulteney Street.
Yeah. Yes, it was closer to North Terrace originally, and it shifted beyond
Rundle Street, didn't it?
Yeah, beyond Rundle Street or Rundle Mall. Yes, well, anyway, I think it was our view that the university itself should take over the activity, but the university declined to do so, but it allowed the union to negotiate with the WEA book room. Now, with the building extensions, you know, was it the mid-60s, when the whole of the Wills Plaza was recreated, the Wills building replaced the old psych building, Bar Smith Library, Staff Club. I discovered that the then Deputy Vice Chancellor, Noel Flinchy, was being approached by the Executive Secretary, Williams, of the WEA, to allow the WEA book room, which was going to be demolished, and that was the original union room, you remember, to allow that book room to get new premises on the Wills Plaza. Well, I managed to get the council to stop those negotiations and to give the Adelaide University Union the exclusive right of conducting book-selling activities on the North Terrace campus. We negotiated with the WEA. Chris Herford was the then chairman of the WEA board. Now, I think I have to be honest enough to say that I'm not the best negotiator that there is. I'm a bit too blunt. But we had two superb negotiators, Oscar Jones, who was the warden of the union, and Jim Bettison.
Now, Oscar was before Ralph Middenway, is that
yes.
right?
Yeah. Oscar followed Frank Borland,
yeah.
and then Oscar went from the warden union to be secretary of the Waite Institute, and he was followed in the union by Ralph Middenway. But they were superb negotiators. They were smoother characters. And anyway, they succeeded in persuading the handover of the WEA book room to the Adelaide University Union. And the three of us negotiated with the National Bank to build us the building. Now, Rob, if you look carefully, it's part of the union extensions, as it were, and it was designed by Dixon and Platten to be consistent architecturally with the new union extensions, also to be consistent with the then still existing George Murray and Lady Simon. And if you look at it, you can see the connection, I think. But also, if you look carefully, it's a standalone building.
Mm.
It is not connected, it is not part of the union, and we had special permission from the University Council, which had delegated authority both from the state government and the city council, because that's park lands.
Yeah.
So we had special permission to build this standalone building. We negotiated it with the National Bank. We had a special arrangement with the National Bank, which was given banking facilities. We tried to do it with the State Bank. The old State Bank had the sole savings branch there in the original in the original union. We couldn't get anywhere with it, but we got it with the National Bank. And it saddened me once I was presiding at a council meeting as Deputy Chancellor when it came up that the university had transferred its banker from the National Bank to, what is it now?
Bank SA.
Yeah, Bank SA. I was in the chair. I expected to be informed of this. It came up in a council meeting. It had been done by the then bursar. And I immediately after the council meeting, I went to the chancellor's room, sat down. I asked the registrar's secretary to get the registrar to come and see me. I made him stand up in front of me as an old army officer. And I said, Frank, this is Frank O'Neill. Frank, what's going on? That's the only time I've ever heard him swear. And I'm going to say what he actually said to me. He said, I said, what's happening? Why wasn't I told? And he said, I left it to David and he fucked it up. Well, I mean, what could you do? We were committed because he was one of the statutory officers of the university. He committed the university to this transfer of banker from one to the other. And it was a great shock and a disappointment to me that a bank which had so well helped us with the bookshop should just have been discarded.
Harry, on the subject of the bookshop itself being a separate building, I've spoken with Bob Dixon and I've seldom heard an architect voice such delight at a project as the Union Hall, but the additional building of the bookshop. And obviously it was a very special building for many people.
Yeah.
Yourself, the architect, Ralph Middenmay, others involved at the time.
Yeah.
A very, very special piece of university history.
Yeah. And they've thrown it away. I don't even know where the bookshop is.
No, I can't tell you that, Harry.
No.
So, just reverting to something you said, though, the WEA bookshop, which was at the rear of the Mitchell Building, had that been the union room which had been used as a union library, had it? Is that what it was originally?
That was the original union room for men.
For men. Is that where the library was too, Harry?
Yeah. Yeah. Which library?
They had a small library.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, yeah they did. Yep. There's a photograph of the there's a photograph of it in Margaret Finnis's lower level.
Yeah, we've just been looking at some of the old press cuttings, and there's a photo in there of people using the small library.
Yeah. Terrible thing. The women weren't allowed, in spite of the fact that it was in 1881. I think Queen Victoria gave the letters patent to Adelaide University to have degrees in science and to admit women.
Mm.
Decades before even Oxford, and almost as, not quite a century, I think 80 years before Cambridge.
Yeah. Well, Melbourne, the first Australian university with a woman graduate, I think, beat Adelaide by a year.
Yeah.
But the edict had come through earlier for Adelaide than Melbourne, I think. Something like that.
1881 it was allowed, and Edith Emily Dornwell took a bit longer to get her degree. She was the first woman to graduate in science in fact, my wife gave the first commemoration address at that I've got it here somewhere. Yeah, it was 1 year after Melbourne. But she was the first woman graduate in science.
Hmm. Now, Harry, carrying on that theme of the expansion of the university, I wonder if we could come to talk a little about Kathleen Lumley, because this follows on, in a sense, with the expansion of that era. Now, university colleges go back to the formation of St Mark's and then St Andrews, which only lasted a decade, and eventually St Anne's for women. But how did Kathleen Lumley come about?
What was the second one you said?
St Andrews.
Where's that?
It was where Mercedes College is now.
Oh.
At what was called Strathspey, the Duncan House.
Oh.
It was there for 10 years, from about 1928 to 38.
Oh. And Aquinas?
Yes, that comes in later.
Yeah.
Later again. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah. That's in the 40s.
Lincoln?
Yeah.
Well, St Anne's and Kathleen Lumley are the two non-systemic university colleges. Kathleen Lumley is the only postgraduate, and it was created. The initial movers were Sir Kenneth Wills, who was the then chair of the Finance Committee and subsequently for 2 years Chancellor of the university. He was the brother to Kathleen Lumley. She had been Kathleen Wills and married to Lumley. I believe the Lumley name itself has changed from another name.
Oh.
You might like to...
One can only guess.
Yeah. I'll tell you off the record what I think about the other name, but I won't say any more now. Kathleen Lumley. And Henry Baston was Vice-Chancellor. Bob Fisher tells me that he wrote the, or was involved in the writing of the first draft of the Constitution. It was created by a formal resolution of the Council of Adelaide University in 1965. And I think I've given in that paper the date.
8th of November 1965.
Yes. The original 1965 gift, I've shown in that paper, $60,000. It was actually £30,000, of course.
Yeah.
That was matched by the state government, £30,000, and the total of £60,000 was then matched by the Commonwealth government through the Australian Universities Commission. At $125,000, the university kindly donated land. They also demolished a number of the cottages to make room for the college. It was conceived initially that the college would be for 120 residents. There was initially accommodation for 60 residents, but the common facilities were said to be sufficient for the 120. We have never been able to get it up to 120. Sir Kenneth Wills was involved, as I say, because he'd been chair of the Finance Committee, and at the time he and the then bursar, Wally Meiklejohn, was surreptitiously buying land there at Lower North Adelaide. And I say surreptitiously. They bought quite a large lump of that land between Finner Street and McKinnon Parade. And it ran right up to where Bob Dixon's house is at the present time. And it was hoped that it would be able to use that land for university purposes. But consistently, the City Council has declined to allow it to be used for any educational purposes, except one. The Centre for Aboriginal Studies in Music was allowed to be set up at in Finner Street. Now, I was a member of what was then the Faculty of Music. It became the Faculty of Performing Arts, was one of those involved in the original creating of the Centre for Aboriginal Studies in Music. And that was a very interesting... We used to have to get the instruments back from Trim's on Monday morning. But it did a marvellous job. It produced a number of orchestras, a number of musicians, indigenous orchestras. It got the young boys out of jail. It got them off of alcohol and drugs. And on our working party, Clem Leskey was director of the Elder Conservatorium at the time, and I think he chaired it. People like George Mayo and Harry Medlin were on it, and we were all in favour of doing it. And Charlie Perkins,
yep. The
late Charlie Perkins, we were all in favour of trying to do something to help them. Also, we had to the police were pests. police are not allowed to come onto the campus of Adelaide University except with permission of the management. We tried to get that authority extended to the Centre for Original Centre for Aboriginal Studies and Music. We were not able to, and they used to come in there and just harass these kids. Well, I think Ben Yenge, you know Ben?
No.
Sudanese. Ben was secretary of CASM. I think he's now back in the Sudan trying to set up a hospital there. He's got his whole family here. He's Christian.
Yeah.
So he is Sudanese. He is African. He's not Arab. And that's what the troubles are around that part of the world. Anyway, I don't think I told you, if I did, excuse me, but when Aboriginalisation took over, and Charlie Perkins and there was another fellow, they were keen that the whole centre would be run by Indigenous or Aboriginal people, and they got rid of Ben. And the press came to see Ben in Finner Street, and he said, no, I didn't think I could be discriminated against because I was too black. Very black. He shifted from there down at the Theberton establishment. Yeah.
So, Harry, Kathleen Lumley was a great success for the university despite not being able to achieve the numbers originally planned for. It has been a most successful attribute. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. This year is the 40th year of its intake of the first three students. We have a record of all of them. When the chairman before me, the late Harold Rodder, died, a scholarship fund was set up for funding students, funding them in the sense that fees or part of the fees would be demitted. I have a list here of those who contributed. I believe that the college will try a similar activity. The Harold J. Rodder Memorial Scholarships can contribute something like the demitting of $1,000. That means that you need in a fund that is going to be hedged against inflation 20 times that, because you can get the tax-free body 4-5%. So you can get $1,000. A friend of mine recently, or a year or so ago, was put on the council, and he set up a council of Kathleen Lumley College, and he set up a working party to try and extend its activities into further scholarships. In other words, a raising of a series of $20,000 scholarships for the demitting of fees. And college now being 40 years old, there are things that need to be done. Mm. And with the University of South Australia and indeed the University of Adelaide, with student facilities up in town, we need to, well, the college needs to keep things up to date. I personally think that a little too much is made of that, because Dixon and Platten were pretty far-sighted architects, and the facilities are pretty satisfactory. I had here fairly recently the president of the Singapore chapter, and I put him in one of the yep. rooms there, and he was more than satisfied with, and he's likely to be back here again in November. There's a general manager of one of the banks, might even be the National Bank, I don't know his name, but there are getting to be some influential people who have been residents of the college, Jane Lomax Smith was one of them, but.
So it obviously has had good use, Harry, over the year.
Yeah.
By people who've made their mark.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. Harry, could we move on from Kathleen Lumley, because you've also written a paper about that that's worth saying on the record that should be seen in conjunction with this interview, I think. The paper you put together on Kathleen Lumley should be read in conjunction with what we're talking about, that's what I'm suggesting.
Yeah. Well, before you leave it entirely, you will notice that I got one section in that paper about a sexual harassment case that came before us, where the complainant, who was just an honours student at Flinders University, was allowed by me into the college because it's a postgraduate college and we don't regard honours students as postgraduates, was allowed in the college because she was said to have said that her life was being threatened down at Flinders. So we let her in, and she brought a case for sexual harassment and changed it during the lawsuit to sexual discrimination. You've seen in the paper where I've abstracted Justice O'Loughlin's. Oh, and we were advised by the staff association at the university and by the university's equal employment officer to give in. Now, I don't give in. And the master and I really fought this out, and it did cost us $40,000, and we won it finally. And O'Loughlin was very... in fact, he said how rigorous I had been in the court. When you're accused of something you didn't do... We were said not to have a sexual... a policy. Well, we did, and I had indeed, as a member of the council, had it copied from the university's own sexual harassment policy and modified to suit, and it was on the notice board, it was available. So anyway, I made a point of that, and in my view the university was responsible and should have been financially responsible. We won the case with costs. The student was bankrupt. We couldn't get anything from the student. That letter that I drafted, and it was sent to both the Chancellor McWhorr and the Vice-Chancellor, the Chancellor de Crepney and the Vice-Chancellor McWhorr, was never even answered. They ignored the case. And it goes on in that letter to claim that the university has not honoured the original resolution in November of 1965 to provide an equal area of space for the further expansion of the college to 120. Mm. Now that difficulty occurred while Mary O'Kane was vice chancellor, and I've quoted from the interchanges between the master and me on the one hand, Mary O'Kane on the other. Just now. And that sort of cursory relation between familial members is to me unacceptable.
Mm.
But I think that period where unsatisfactory relations with the college led to a general deterioration in the collegiality of the university into managerialism and arrogance, central arrogance, which is further increased. And I'm sorry to report that Kathleen Lumley seemed to have been one of the starting victims of this change in attitude.
I'll just stop this, Harry. I'll create a new document.